You are now going to listen to KAZI Book Review with Hopeton Hay.
Welcome to this special edition of KAZI Book Review. Today we are featuring excerpts from the Diverse Scholars Speaking Truth to Power panel discussion from the 5th Annual Celebration of Diverse Literary Voices of Texas, held virtually on January 30th. The panel lasted an hour, so we excerpted the first 22 minutes of the discussion and the closing comments from each panelist. The full panel discussion will be available soon at Hopeton Hay Podcasts, which is available on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, iHeartRadio, or at Podomatic.com. University of Texas at Austin student Vanessa Aguirre introduced the panel featuring scholars Theodore Francis, John Moran Gonzalez, Matthew Petway, and Priya Satya.
I have the privilege of introducing all the scholars on our panel today. So our first one is Theodore Francis, who is an assistant professor of history at Hudson-Tilson University, where he teaches courses on African-American, Caribbean, and United States history. He co-authored Prudent Rebels, Bermudians in the First Age of Revolution, an Atlantic history examining the activities of enslaved and white Bermudians during the American, French, and Haitian revolutions. His current research focuses on Black travel and tourism during the 20th century, and he is presently working on a manuscript exploring the role of African-American tourism during the civil rights struggle to desegregate Bermuda. Our second scholar is John Moran Gonzalez, who is a co-editor of Reverberations of Racial Violence, Critical Reflections on the History of the Border, and is professor of English at the University of Texas at Austin, welcome, and director of the Center for Mexican American Studies. He is also author of Border Renaissance, the Texas Centennial, and the Emergence of Mexican American Literature, and the Troubled Union, Expansionist Imperatives in Post-Reconstruction American Novels. His research interests are in Latino-Latina literature, Chicano-Chicana literature, late 19th century American literature, narrative theory, and post-colonial studies. And our third scholar is Matthew Petway, who is an assistant professor of Spanish at the University of South Alabama and author of Cuban Literature in the Age of Black Insurrection, Manzano, Placido, and Afro-Latino Religion, which explores how Black Cuban colonial authors Juan Francisco Manzano and Gabriel de la Concepción Valdez, also known as Placido, transformed otherwise conventional literature into an instrument of emancipation. He's interested in what we might learn from Black Cuban intelligentsia if we make religion a critical lens for the analysis of their literary texts. And that last but certainly not least is Priya Satya, who is a professor of history and international history at Stanford University. She is the author of Time's Monster, How History Makes History, which focuses on the role of the modern historical imagination in the history of the British Empire, while also recovering alternative ethical visions embraced by anti-colonial thinkers. She's also the author of Empire of Guns, The Violent Making of the Industrial Revolution. She specializes in modern British and British Empire history, especially in the Middle East and South Asia. Her work examines the ways in which the imperial past has shaped the present and how the ethical dilemmas it posed were understood and managed. So welcome, everyone.
Yes, thank you.
And thank you very much to Vanessa Aguirre for making the introductions to our panel. And I'm real excited to have such a distinguished panel of scholars to be part of Diverse Literary Voices of Texas. And I think that scholars and professors really play an important role in our society today. And I think they really play an important role during these times of the cry for social justice, because it's the scholars like Matthew and Theodore and Priya and John that really make a big difference in making sure that the truth that we all need to make sure that is shared with the public, that the alternative views of the world, and welcome back, John Moran Gonzalez, and that the truths are shared. And so I'm going to start by posing a question in the light of the theme of the event today, speaking truth to power. And starting with you, Matthew, how do you believe that your work as a scholar, and specifically your book, plays a significant role in helping the public to understand the importance of speaking Truth to Power. Matthew.
Thank you for having me. I think in a lot of ways with Cuban literature in the age of Black insurrection, what I wanted to achieve was to move beyond the critique of racism. I think that anti-racist work is very important, but that we need to pay attention to the systems of knowledge, the bodies of knowledge that are hidden, that have been buried essentially by colonialism and by white supremacy. And so in looking at Juan Francisco Manzano, which is a sort of a Cuban Frederick Douglass, and Gabriel de la Concepción Valdez or Plácido is kind of like a Martin Delaney type figure, but in Cuba, I really sought to point to the fact that people of African descent are constantly looking to knowledge systems as a way of challenging the status quo. So I think what's interesting about the story of Manzano and Plácido is certainly that the Catholic symbols they were presented with, images of the Virgin Mary, Catholic saints, for example, were used in the interest of Black freedom. What they were able to do is that they were able to use those symbols, giving them a double meaning, kind of a double entendre. So that in the case of Manzano, for example, St. Anthony, who had been transculturated with the Spirit of the Crossroads, could be a stand-in for El Legua or the Spirit of the Crossroads when Manzano needed to use him in that way. So the double valence there was very powerful. But with regard to our contemporary moment, what was challenging for the Spanish colonial government was the fact that Manzano and Plácido were able to communicate with enslaved Blacks, as Manzano himself had been enslaved as a Cuban Frederick Douglass of sorts, as well as with free people of African descent, men and women. And it was their ability to communicate with them and to use poetry as a weapon to become the architects of discourse that really made the Spanish colonial state so incredibly afraid. So it was not possible for people of African descent in the colonial Spanish America, unless they got special permission from the crown, to study in university systems. Manzano and Plácido, in many ways, were as close as you could get, though they were autodidacts like Douglass, right? And so what was so challenging for the Spanish colonial state is that they were able to spread messages surreptitiously in a clandestine fashion, and they were able to get people to begin to question whether or not this oppression was divinely ordained. So the relationship between salvation and freedom is challenged in their work, right? Spanish Catholic notion of freedom that would free the soul but leave the body in chain. And instead, what they sought to do was to procure the power necessary to free themselves through African-inspired ritual. So that's what my book deals with. I think it speaks to our contemporary moment because it encourages us to look for alternative ideas of freedom. And it encourages, my book encourages us to look for knowledge systems that have been discarded, perhaps because of Judeo-Christian prejudice or because of capitalist dictates.
Thank you, Matthew. And I want to go to Theodore because Bermuda, I believe, was the second British colony in the Western Hemisphere. And I've been to Bermuda. And in your book, Prudent Rebels, you explore the ways in which Bermudian mariners and merchants, both enslaved and free, brought new ideas of liberty, equality, and humanity, which aided in the creation of the United States of America, the Haitian Revolution, and the abolition of slavery. In particular, there's a tie between both Matthew's book and your book deal with the role of the Haitian Revolution in inspiring people. So talk about it, Theodore.
Yes, sir. Good afternoon. And thanks again, Hopeton, for inviting me this afternoon. And greetings again to all my fellow panelists. In terms of thinking about what my work contributes or pushes towards this contemporary moment, it's a number of things. But first, I want to just acknowledge my co-authors, because this wasn't a single project. And I'd be remiss if I did not mention both Dr. Clarence Maxwell, as well as Alexandra Mayers Kessler, who were my co-authors on this project. So grateful for them. And I wish they could be there here as well, but I'm gonna try and do my best to speak for them as well in my response. I'm talking about the things that I think this work speaks to for this moment is, in particular, what you see in Bermuda is that Bermuda's role as a trading colony, and I mean that not just in terms of all types of products from salt to meat, to building materials, but also as a key location of the trading of enslaved men and women and children, right? Bermuda plays a key role in the introduction of the, quote, initial or charter generation of captive Africans, which entered Virginia colony in 1619, even though we don't necessarily address that in the book per se, that is the kind of context from which we're speaking. And this is what situates Bermuda's importance in the Atlantic world prior to the American Revolution. Two of the things I think which are useful in terms of the ways in which we look at Bermudians and talk about Bermuda's contribution to the American Revolution, as well as the other revolutions which unfolded in the late 18th and early 19th century, is the ways in which we see the white elites of Bermuda working in partnership with the elites, both in America, both colonial elites, and then as well, once the colonial elites are losing power, they're working with the American patriots. They do that in ways such as negotiating exceptions to the famous trade embargo that the Continental Congress passed in 1775 that was intended to really weaken the British Empire. But white Bermudians send a delegation to Philadelphia, and they speak, of course, to the Continental Congress. They speak to the Pennsylvania Committee on Safety, and they negotiate an exception to that in order to allow products to be smuggled through Bermuda, even in the midst of this massive trade embargo, which is affecting other parts of the colonial world. That is done in exchange for gunpowder. So Bermudians actually smuggle gunpowder to the American patriots in 1775, in the summer of 1775. And that particular smuggling mission, as well as several smuggling missions before and after this moment in 1775, are facilitated by enslaved African mariners, right? The enslaved play this critical role in the fact that they are property, and therefore, if they are ever apprehended, they cannot testify against whites, right? Mm-hmm. So you see this critical role of subordinated labor in the form of captive African men, mostly men and boys, who operate as mariners on these smuggling voyages. However, on the other side of this, and what we really try and tease out, is the work or the opportunities that smuggling enables for captive Africans working aboard these vessels. It enables them to create a kind of or function within a wider network of travel. They link with Black people in Haiti, for example, Saint-Domingue, before it becomes Haiti, of course. They link with Black people throughout the Spanish Caribbean. They link with Black people throughout the French Caribbean, as well as other British islands, where so that even in the midst of their captivity and the ways in which they are being utilized by this system to ferry goods illicitly, right, they still manage to create a kind of diaspora set of relationships that we explore how these diaspora relationships end up pushing back against slavery. And I can give a number of examples, but as we have our conversation, I'll speak to a few more specifics of that. So we see white international power at one level being facilitated, but we also see this kind of diasporic power from below being facilitated by these same operations. And that's one of the things that hopefully we can explore a little bit more. So thank you.
Thank you, Theodore. So Priya, I'm going to go to you because we're talking about, we just went from Bermuda, which was part of the British Empire, to your book, where you examine the role of British historians in justifying British imperialism. And one of the things that points that your book made was the importance of who was telling the story, whether it was the historians working on behalf of the British Empire, or whether it was the story being told from the point of view of the indigenous people of, say, for example, India. So how does your book, Time's Monster, How History Makes History, how does it address speaking truth to power?
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
Thank you, Hopton, for including me in this conversation. And it's really nice to get to meet these other scholars. Hello to all of you. And I already, just hearing what you're saying, hear some really amazing connections between the things we're working on. So it's a real pleasure to get to meet you and know more about your work. Speaking truth to power, this book, Time's Monster, is really about tells the story of how historians shifted from being those allied with power, and then after, in the period of decolonization, and also in the period of the Vietnam War, I think you can bring that American angle in as well. You see them taking this position of saying, actually, our job as historians is to speak truth to power. Mm-hmm. And then they take this much more critical position towards those in power. And so I tell the story of how historians had been sort of the architects of the British Empire. If you can think of people like, Winston Churchill as the peak of sort of a prime minister who's also a really popular historian, but then going all the way back to the 18th century, there are historians who have a lot of political influence, whether it's Joseph Priestley or Thomas Macaulay or John Stuart Mill, or, you know, there are many other examples. And so, but at the same time, as you were saying, Hopton, I trace the kind of critical voices pushing back against that use of history. And just going back to something that Matthew brought up, I mean, a lot of it was in a poetic form. And so then you get to this point, so I look at, Caribbean thinkers and Indian thinkers and Middle Eastern thinkers who are all saying, well, the problem with the kind of outlook of people like Macaulay or the Mills or even someone like Churchill is that they're always saying, when things feel morally wrong in the present, you need to set that feeling aside and do it anyway, because it's going to fulfill some greater historical purpose in the form of progress down the line. And then you have these anti-colonial thinkers who are saying, no, we need to be ethically accountable in the present, right? And this is something associated with, Mahatma Gandhi, but also Tolstoy. I mean, also in many other thinkers around the world. Even a lot of English and British thinkers too, who are critical of what their government is doing. And so then influenced by all this history in the 1960s, you see a shift in even sort of scholarly historical work, where historians are saying we need to approach this much more poetically and with a much more redemptive ethos. This is someone like E.P. Thompson, right? And that our job as historians is always to call out the lies of those in power and to keep them ethically accountable in the present. And that whether or not that works, whether or not it changes what those in power do, the struggle has value in itself, and recording the truth for what it is has value in itself. So that's again all about being accountable in the present and seeing the value of doing that as a collective endeavor too, having a value of its own. So I'll stop there, but I'm looking forward to talking more.
And I'm going to remind everybody, feel free, as you guys have these great ideas, to comment on each other's comments, to ask each other's questions. You guys are the experts. You guys are the scholars. And I don't mind sitting back and letting you take total control of this discussion. But we're going to come back to Texas with John Moran Gonzalez and Reverberations of Racial Violence. And John, you introduced me a while back to Monica Munoz Martinez, who was the author of The Injustice Never Leaves You, Anti-Mexican Violence in Texas. And that's when I first got exposed to the violence that was perpetrated against Mexicans and Mexican Americans on the border by Texas law enforcement. So talk a bit how you really brought to light, how Monica has brought to light, and you and your co-editor, Sonia Hernandez, bring to light the reverberations of racial violence, critical reflections on the history of the border.
Okay, thank you, Hopton, for the invitation to be on this fantastic panel. I'd like to thank my colleagues on the panel for just already an incredible conversation. And of course, my co-editor on the volume, Sonia Hernandez at Texas A&M, and also my fellow Refusing to Forget members, Chris Carmona, Ben Johnson, Monica Munoz Martinez, and Trini Gonzalez. We make up a collective of a public history project called Refusing to Forget. And we started about almost 10 years ago now, with the project of bringing to public consciousness the events of 100, now over 100 years ago, that occurred in Deep South Texas, mainly in the lower Rio Grande Valley of Texas, but also in other parts of, that is between 1910 and 1920, we estimate that at least 1,000 Mexican and Mexican Americans, that is U.S. citizens, were summarily executed with no semblance of due process by the Texas Rangers and by local law enforcement, county level. And despite this horrific series of events, This is almost utterly forgotten, except by two groups of people, historians of South Texas and the border, and the descendants of those who were affected by this violence. And so, you know, it has been erased from Texas history, you know, whether it's at the fourth and seventh grade levels or even into college. And in the official historical records of the state. But the story resonates with today, that is, of speaking truth to power, because, of course, it's engaging in, I think, what is a kind of become a more general project of doing so, of critiquing the encountering the invisible forms of institutional violence that people of color in this country and elsewhere inhabit on a daily basis. So I'm thinking of the kind of instances of racial violence that hide in plain sight as, say, Confederate monuments, you know, as well as institute and practices of policing that prevent full accountability of those involved. So. The point of refusing to forget in kind of seeking historical markers from the Texas Historical Commission or coming up with this anthology is really to outline, to give a fuller accounting than has been given before to both the violence, but also to what people of Mexican descent in Texas did to counteract this violence, right? To become agents of history. And so it's not all about victimization, but rather about how even in that moment, you know, even during the 1910s, you know, Mexican descent people were seeking recourse through both the Texas legal system, that is through the Texas legislature. In 1919, the sole Mexican-American representative, J.T. Canales, initiated a in-depth investigation of the Texas Rangers. And we can get to later about the effectiveness of it, but nonetheless, there was a challenge to the kind of spoken supremacy of these sorts of police actions against communities of color. And then secondly, how, you know, even Mexican nationals had recourse to pursue claims of restitution through the Mexican consulates. And in one of these kind of quick twists of history, that oftentimes they had more agency in being able to seek justice than US citizens. Mm. And so that's what kind of one of the many, many kind of ironies that this situation kind of, you know, that we have looked at here in the volume. But I'll go ahead and leave it at that so we can go on to a fuller discussion.
Priya, I want you to talk a little bit about Samuel Galton, the historical protagonist of your previous book, Empire of Guns, because it was his life that actually inspired you to write this book, because this was a Quaker, don't believe in war, in the manufacturing of guns industry. Mm. And how do they justify, this Quaker justify providing guns and being part of a religion that's against war?
Yeah, thank you, Hopton. Yeah, Samuel Galton was sort of the main character in my previous book, and I thought I was done with him. And then I realized he was telling me something not just about, so that earlier book was about the Industrial Revolution and how it was driven by military contracting. But then I realized he not only was telling me about that, he was telling us about the way, the ethical uses of history from that period onward. So what happens is he has these deeply held, very sincere commitments as a Quaker, you know, that war is unchristian. But when, you know, and his family, however, is involved in manufacturing guns for decades and decades without that raising a lot of eyebrows within the Quaker community, until finally it does, and there's a scandal, and the Quaker community says, you need to stop manufacturing guns. This goes against Quaker principle. And he says, well, in the situation in which Providence has placed me, I have no other choice. So he's not saying that, you know, God is actually making him do anything. What he's saying is that Providence is like, there's a providentially unfolding history. There's a history unfolding that's divinely guided, and his hands are tied. The only thing he can do, because Providence says that Britain is continually at war in this period, and that any industrial activity he could pursue around him would inevitably be related to war. And so he's in this ethical bind, he says, basically, I have to set aside my commitments as a Quaker and fulfill this historical purpose for the British nation and empire. And so he goes ahead and he becomes the biggest gun manufacturer in the country for that period. And I realized he was not just a gun maker, he was an Enlightenment figure. So he was in conversation with philosophers like Joseph Priestley, who were writing books about the ethical uses of history and saying exactly the same thing, that sometimes we need to suspend our ordinary ethical judgment and allow history to vindicate things that might seem morally questionable in the present. And Priestley also said that war is one of those things. It's like a necessary evil. But of course, they did have more choices. We can look back and say they had more choices than they thought they did. I mean, Galton could have said, I'm a Quaker, I don't wanna do this, right? And then things would have turned out differently. Or if that other historical idiom, ethical idiom didn't exist, he wouldn't have been able to justify what he's doing with that, right? So that's where the story starts, kind of revisiting Galton and then tracing like similar instances of that kind of logic all the way up to our present.
Thank you very much, Priya, because I just think that's such a great that story. I did not know that about Galton, and now you're gonna compel me to buy more books. But you can see I already have a problem doing that already. But
that's
yes.
What I'm here for.
Right? But I think you hit on something that at least it resonated with me. And this is like these contradictions of the Enlightenment, right? You know, these kind of historical contradictions, these things that, you know, and I think every one of our speakers have so far spoken to this in their own different ways, but the way it resonated with me was that these contradictions and the ways in which these historical subjects, you, in your case, Galton, operates in a certain way, which we now look at as historians as saying, this is contradictory. This doesn't seem to match your ethical position. However, they create a kind of case law or a justification, which then becomes utilized at a later moment, right? It stuck out with me in the context of what I'm working on is because you're speaking of this Enlightenment moment or what I've worked on with my colleagues is that many of these Bermudians who actually assisted these American patriots, got them gunpowder, helped them smuggle salt and munitions in and out of the 13 colonies while they're waging war against Britain, many of them think of themselves as loyal British subjects. They would never call themselves rebels. And on a couple of times throughout Prudent Rebels, we see that the colonial governor in Bermuda, Bruère and others, are castigating these white Bermudian smugglers as being rebels and speaking very negatively about the ways in which they utilize slave labor, most centrally, because they all recognize that slave labor is powering this capacity to smuggle. However, this idea to hold these contradictory ideologies or these contradictory positions at once and create a kind of justifying logics around them is very powerful because you also see it mirrored in terms of the Americans with this kind of construction of a republic of freedom, which is, you know, basically founded around slavery, right? So we can push these things very far as well, but I just thought that was a very compelling insight. So thank you for that. And sorry, Hopeton, for diving in.
No, I'm going to ask everyone else to dive in.
Well, that's actually great. I wanted to say something to John Moran, what you say with regard to Mexican citizens or Mexican nationals actually being able to acquire redress more easily than some U.S. citizens. I'd love to hear more of what you thought about that or why that was the case. Well, what caught my ear, I had a question that I want to tell you what caught my ear and how I think it relates to my work. Very briefly, when did this take place, the 1,000 Mexicans and Mexican-Americans being massacred?
Yeah, we're talking about the decade of 1910 to 1920.
Okay. This is before World War One. It's after the way after the Mexican American War. But the whole notion of these people becoming agents of history versus its victims really caught my eye because it makes me think of the way that Plácido, for example, who was born free in 1809, was put into an orphanage essentially by his white mother. His father was of African descent, raised by his black grandmother. How he then gets some schooling up to about the age, by age to sixth grade or something of the sort. He has some African descended teachers, which was not actually uncommon in colonial Cuba, but it's his ability to improvise poetry. It's his autodidacticism essentially that puts him in a position to be able to become an agent of history. So he could have just been a bard kind of on the periphery, somebody who produced poetry that really was far outside of the norms. He would mix images in a way that didn't typically make sense. But what he actually is able to do, I think because of his knowledge of oral tradition, is he's able to speak to two audiences at once. And so he's able to take an image, for example, he has this poem about carnival. And he talks about the African masquerade called the Little Devil, Diablito. Dice que nadie entiende a Diablito. What is he doing? The little devil is a foolish character in the street making a bunch of noise. And he talks about the onlookers looking upon this character with scorn and derision. But then he says, what they don't know is he has come to bring the law upon them. He has come to impose the law upon them. So Plácido is talking about an African masquerade figure that doesn't operate in and of itself independently. It's tied to an African brotherhood. An African brotherhood, not a mulatto brotherhood, not a brotherhood of free people of color, but of African people. And they were involved in the 1844 anti-slavery movement, which Plácido was accused of being part of. These poets were such a threat to the Spanish Empire that the Spanish Empire didn't say this is, wouldn't utter the word Haiti in any of its documents. And not only that, none that I've seen, and not only that, they said this is in fact a conspiracy devised by the people of color to exterminate the white population. So once again, we come back to the contemporary moment. We think about the insurrection at the Capitol, the white supremacist insurrection at the Capitol. We take into consideration that whole notion that white people are threatened when in fact they hold the bulk of the power within the society. And that extraordinary violence is somehow justified to secure their position, right? And we have to ask ourselves, how do we then become agents of history in this moment? We don't know how it's going to turn out, but how do we become agents of history in this moment, despite all of that? And so I wanted for you, I just wanted to hear a little bit more about how Mexican citizens were able to actually get redress and therefore become agents of history where Mexican Americans were not in Texas.
Well, thank you, Matthew. That's a great question. And I am convinced I just have to go out and buy all of y'all's books and read them. it's just so fascinating because I think there are so many elements that I think we can speak to each other about. You know, specifically on your question, Matthew, on how Mexican nationals perhaps had better redress, a better chance of restitution or justice compared to their Mexican-American relatives, right, who were U.S. citizens, is in that they could turn to, and often did, to the Mexican consulates, to the consuls, and report these instances of violence and discrimination in which the diplomats would then lodge a formal protest with the U.S. consulate, United States State Department. And in that way, what happened was that, of course, the State Department is concerned with, as it were, big picture foreign relations. And they would in turn put pressure upon state authorities to the extent that they could. To say like you really have to kind of cut this out. And in certain instances, there were bilateral commissions to address these instances of violence, especially in the wake of the Mexican Revolution, where there were claims and counterclaims from both sides. about the need for restitution, that is, you know, violence against U.S. citizens and property in Mexico during the revolution, and then violence against Mexican citizens and their property in the U.S. at the same period. So, however, for the Mexican Americans who are U.S. citizens, their recourse was through the local state justice systems, which of course would not convict, much less, you know, well, would not indict, much less convict any law enforcement or even white person in crimes against Mexicans, ethnic Mexicans. And so it was that level of seeking redress through another nation state that, you know, had its own, their interests in mind, rather than U.S. citizens who had zero, you know, the government had zero interest in keeping their rights at the forefront. So and so it's in that sense, you know, one of the kind of ironies or, you know, contradictions, if you will, is that, you know, foreign nationals had more ability to seek justice than nationals. And that is something that, you know, is I think, I mean, it's repeated, you know, in many ways. I mean, and it's specifically on along racial lines. I mean, it's not unique to Mexican descent people, but it speaks to the kind of white supremacist order that, you know, the government was essentially set up to uphold. I also wanted to speak very quickly to Priya's comment about the kind of ability to hold, you know, contradictory kind of stances. And I think it's a really great way of thinking how, while one, the Texas Rangers and local law enforcement could carry out these, you know, complete violation of what they were sworn to uphold, right, in terms of due process of the law. But once again, very much in the service of a grander narrative, of saying that this was a white man's country, right? That was the narrative that they were invested in furthering along, as it were. I also do think, though, that there is this question of how institutional power was used to facilitate this, right? So in other words, there were also very much statements by the governor to the Texas Rangers that, you know, he would pardon them if any of them ever got indicted, right?
It's not simply
about ideology, but it's about institutional practice.
You got a pardon in my back pocket when you need it.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what the questions around qualified immunity today are also speaking to.
Indeed.
Well, Priya, I do want to ask you, Priya, about this apocalypse now, the Heart of Darkness, and what did that novel written by Joseph Conrad, how did that expose the hypocrisy of imperialism?
Oh, yeah, that comes up in my book that, you know, Conrad goes out to the Congo and he's horrified by what he sees, and he writes a novel that's supposed to expose the hypocrisy of empire and the horror of European imperialism. The kind of villain of the whole thing is Kurtz, right? So the book is like he's looking for Kurtz, and then he finally meets him, and Kurtz is a character who embodies all those contradictory traits of the liberal imperialist, right? He's part of this society to improve the lives, you know, civilizing mission with good intentions ostensibly in sub-Saharan Africa. And then, but scrawled at the bottom of his report is this, you know, exterminate the brutes. And so where does that exterminationist kind of mentality come from when you are ostensibly pursuing these ends of upliftment, which are, you know, racist enough in their own way. And so he's sort of bringing out the kind of the sheer horror of that. The way that good intentions or the claims to good intentions were exactly what enabled the violence and racism of empire. And so that book sort of is an unmasking, but I mean, as lots of literary critics, and Matthew, you're here today, you know, have pointed out, it's really, it's a pretty racist book in its own way, in the way it depicts African characters and so on. But that does come up in the book because at the turn of the 20th century, there is this moment when a lot of Europeans and British people, and you know, a Conrad is a Polish immigrant to England, but are aware and worried about the kind of how the past century of imperial history looks. And they're saying, you know, like Wilfred Blunt says, we should sit with ashes on our head and mourn what we have done. You know, a lot of people are talking like this, but today when people defend, a lot of British people who, you know, like even the Boris Johnson government, they will defend empire and not even acknowledge the burden of guilty conscience that actually has been there episodically in the entire history of empire. So again, to go back to what you were saying about history, I mean, we need to kind of, it's a constant contest over historical narratives. You know, was Texas a, you know, a white people's place, or obviously not? I mean, that's just really bad history. And so we have to counter it with better versions of history, more, you know, speaking truth to power, going back to your original point, Hopton.
Well, let me ask, I'm gonna put everybody on the spot here because we've been living in my lifetime. This is the most tumultuous times of my lifetime. This may be, this is definitely the most tumultuous past year in this country of this century. And we have two historians, a Spanish scholar and an English scholar who also dabble in history. So I want you to put on your historian hats. And in 1 minute, I'm gonna pull that timer out. in 1 minute, how would you describe the history of this past year? And let's just, to make it easy, starting with COVID-19, 1 minute. Let's see who can do it. All right, we're going to start with you, Matthew. 1 minute.
Oh, my.
I got the timer out.
Okay. How would we describe the historical moment?
The moment, the past year, okay. Matthew.
I would describe the past year as an instance in which the energy of white supremacy, the discourse, state practices in the United States to make voting more difficult, boiling up, coming to a boiling point. I would also address the way that media and the hands of very few comes to abuse truth so that there's no distinction between fact and fiction, and that conspiracy theory replaces fact, where there's no interest in history, no interest in fact. A moment really where the chickens came home to roost, where on paper, the electorate was able to defeat a very dangerous proto-fascist president, but with a movement that that individual led has become even more emboldened. And so I would describe it as a moment where we're either going to have anti-racist democracy or we're going to have a white supremacist, explicitly white supremacist state. We're at a crossroads.
John?
I would very much agree with that assessment, and I would put it in terms of the past year in terms of the struggle between two competing historical discourses, that is of revolution versus reconstruction. And what I mean by that is that, you know, if you take a look at that insurrection that took place on January 6th, you know, there were a lot of don't tread on me flags and kind of this idea, this reclaiming of the American Revolution as specifically a white supremacist one, right? That this was a white nation, a white Christian nation, and that that's what it needs to stay. It needs to remain that. Mm-hmm. The other discourse is Reconstruction, right? Where there is this, concerted attempt to open up the American experiment to multiracial, anti-racist democracy, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And where Black and brown people and other people of color are very much once agents of history in making that happen. Mm-hmm. And so, this moment is getting, you know, my colleague Piniel Joseph, you know, as the third Reconstruction, right? And so I think we very much have this kind of struggle. Which one is it going to be?
Theodore?
Just to concur both with Matthew and with John, and to add something to that, I'm thankful for John mentioning the central role of the American Revolution in all of this kind of quasi-fascist, heavily white supremacist type of discourse that has been coming up. And once again, the role of history to centralize who was actually in the room and who actually facilitated the creation of this kind of American Republic that some claim that they want to reassert in this moment. After every kind of primary revolutionary moment, you see this kind of questioning of how far should we push the ideologies of the revolution? And we recognize that around the American Revolution with questions around should slavery remain or should it not? It doesn't take till the Civil War to figure that out, that this is a contradictory point in American kind of political discourse. The founders grappled with that idea right immediately after the American Revolution. And I think it's important to recognize that because they knew, they recognized that some of the products that they actually utilized in order to wage that war had been supplied by captive Africans. They recognized that many of the products that they grew and traded in order to secure weapons and so forth had been grown by captive Africans. So this role of subordinated Black people within this kind of empire that claims to be, not an empire, a republic that claims to stand for liberty, has always been a kind of central contradiction in the American state. And the desire to actually fully address that and make those claims of liberty real is really quite arguably what white leaders have to address in this moment, because Blacks, as all of our work have been showing, and people of color, as all of our work has been showing, have been pushing to realize their dream for a long time, from Mary Prince in Bermuda through some of the great scholars and other individuals that my colleagues mentioned. So that would be, I think, the major factor to talk about this recent history.
Priya, I will say you've gotten the biggest advantage because you got to hear everybody first.
I can just say ditto to everybody. Let me try. Let me try to add something and build on. So if I think of last year in the context of the last 60 years, let's say. So I feel like after World War II, we were in this place where the ideas of race and liberal progress that had underwritten, you know, American and European imperialism for the previous couple of centuries were kind of exposed as bankrupt, right? We had the civil rights movement, we had decolonization movements. And then what happens is the Cold War, and then after the Cold War, the War on Terror, and a lot of that awareness gets sort of smothered or muzzled in a way and sort of rewritten and forgotten in a sense. And I feel like, and then we end up on this path from, you know, George Bush to Trump, and then similar kinds of rulers around the world, and it's like a global trend. And then I feel like with climate change upon us and the COVID thing, and then these authoritarian rulers, it sort of forced, it was an unmasking of everything we had suppressed in the Cold War, the War on Terror, and a demand to reckon with that. And I think, you know, Black Lives Matter, Roads Must Fall, all those conversations we're seeing, we want to talk about everything that you're trying to make us forget and not talk about, and we want to reckon with the things we were forced to compete in the world, you know, on the global stage from the 1950s without any reparation, without any, you know, kind of acknowledgement even of what had been done for the previous two centuries to Black and brown people around the world. And the Irish. And so I feel like there's an unmasking and a demand for reckoning, and it's like open now. I don't know where it will go, but I feel like having the conversation and having those movements rather than not having had them for so long is actually a really wonderful thing, whatever happened. So that's where I am. Even though it's so sad that it came with COVID and all this loss and death, right?
So we have about 5 minutes left. There was the first question, and if you can give brief answers, can you address how Native Americans fit into your view of agents of history? And I'm just going to let anyone jump in at any point here. Can you address how Native Americans fit into your view of agents of history?
I can try, but I just spoke, so someone else can go, and then I'll try.
Theodore, Okay. Your box is open there.
Okay, no problem. That was probably just me moving papers, but nothing.
Too late now.
Native Americans moving into there. Once again, Bermuda's got an interesting location as far as Native American culture and the ways in which after King Philip, the so-called King Philip's War, you have a number of captive indigenous people from the Pequot region and parts of Massachusetts being sent on, or New England rather, being sent to Bermuda in captivity. However, the interesting thing about that is Native Americans as agents of history don't just end up becoming subjects of labor in the colony, but they end up some intermarrying with and captive Africans and creating a very vibrant kind of hybrid Atlantic world Native American culture there in the island. So when we think about Native Americans, it's critical because obviously the United States as a republic does not exist without the theft of indigenous land. You know, that's a central contradiction which cannot be avoided. However, the capacity for indigenous people, even under the injustices of colonialism, to still reproduce vibrant cultures, not only in the United States where they might have been dispossessed, but also in parts of the colonial world where they are forcibly relocated, is also something that needs a deeper conversation. Because even when we get into restorative justice or reparatory justice, you know, you've got to address Native American issues and injustices in this colonial project of white supremacy. So actors in the historical narrative, Bermuda contributes that in terms of the Pequot or the so-called Mohawk culture, which grows in Bermuda's West End, St. David's and other parts of the, not West End, East End, St. David's and other parts of the island of Bermuda.
I would say that in Texas, this is an especially important kind of aspect to recover in Texas history, because the narrative in Texas is that indigenous peoples had the project of eradicating indigenous communities had been largely realized, right? Or at least that's the dominant narrative. And so, you know, so except as the kind of antagonist to the Texas Rangers and kind of white settler colonialism during the 19th century, you know, that the contemporary presence is really utterly effaced. Of course, you know, the thing is that these colonial histories are very messy in Texas, because the Mexican and Spanish prior to that also had, you know, similar campaigns, settler colonialist campaigns against indigenous peoples.
Right.
And so it gets kind of triangulated in complex ways. I mean, sometimes there were alliances, but often there were antagonisms as well. Mm-hmm. And so a part of my next project that I'm thinking about is precisely looking at, especially in Deep South Texas, the kind of ways in which indigenous communities survived in ways that were not kind of, you know, recognized by either the state or federal government or even the Mexican government, because of course these are trans-border kind of communities. And so that is something that I'm acutely conscious of my own shortcomings in my scholarship about, but I'm looking forward to, you know, perhaps being able to enter into conversations with Native communities and scholars about, precisely about Texas.
Well, we only have about 2 minutes left, so I'm going to cut off the answering our questions and ask for a closing statement. But I want your statement to focus on, and once again, you're going to be on a time limit. Please don't mind me here. 30 seconds. The importance of reading history today. Why people should read, not just scholars, not just students, but why everyday people should be reading history today. And clearly, this should have been an hour and a half panel, and I have learned my lesson this time. So, but I'm going to ask you to just hit with the 30 seconds, and I am going to start with, since I've known John Moran Gonzalez the longest, I'm going to start with John.
Well, I'm going to keep it short, because Amanda Gorman said it so much better than I could in her poem, The Hill We Climb, and I'll just quote one line, because being American is more than a pride we inherit. It's the past we step into and how we repair it.
All right. Matthew.
I would say that learning history and reading historically significant literature, right, through the literary archaeology that we do is important because it allows you to become an architect of discourse. You're not just listening and regurgitating myth, but you are able to say, this is truth, and I can show you why it's true. And you can galvanize people around a cause to act in the contemporary moment.
Priya.
Yeah, one is I think we need to arm ourselves to engage in these arguments that are really arguments about history, like what is the story of America? What is the story of empire? And the more you read, the more confidently you can do that. Secondly, you don't want to take the world for granted as it is, right? And it gives you a sense of different future possibilities once you've read the past and you understand how we got here and all the alternative futures that we didn't have, but we could still create. Mm-hmm. And lastly, I mean, there's a humanistic value to reading history and communing with the past, that redemptive poetic purpose of history. I mean, history comes out of, you know, the Odyssey or the Mahabharata, that sort of epic poetry of it. In its own way, you know, and I think there's value in doing that. And that also is part of the whole purpose of then being able to engage with the world more securely and with more optimism, actually, and more sense of your right to be here.
Mm-hmm. And Theodore.
Yeah, I'm going to do like John. I'm going to deal with a quote really quick. This is from Dr. Amos Wilson. Peace be upon him. Mm. He says, the rule of history, you know, and I'm a quote, to manipulate history is to manipulate consciousness. To manipulate consciousness is to manipulate possibilities. Mm. And to manipulate possibilities is to manipulate power. Herein lies the mortal threat of Eurocentric historiography to African existence. We can just broaden that. Herein lies the threat to problematic histories. To human existence. History is about how we connect the past to the present. And if we have problematic understandings of that, we're gonna have problematic politics, we're gonna have problematic religion, we're gonna have problematic economies, we're gonna have problematic social relations, mm-hmm. and we're gonna have what we see when we look out the window. So the importance of history. Thank you, my fellow panelists. All of your answers, brilliant.
Matthew Petway, Theodore Francis, Priya Satya, and John Moran Gonzalez, thank you so much for being on this panel, Diverse Scholars at Work, Speaking Truth to Power. Thank you for listening to this podcast edition of KAZI Book Review. I'm Hopeton Hay. Subscribe to us under Hopeton Hay Podcasts on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, iHeartRadio, and many other sources of podcasts. If you like this interview, be sure to rate it. Rate it a 5. Give us 5 stars. You can follow KAZI Book Review on Twitter under @KAZIBooks. You can also follow us under Facebook under KAZI Book Review with Hopeton Hay. And you can also follow us on Instagram under KAZI_book_review. Thank you once again for listening to the KAZI Book Review podcast.